Renee Bressel, Carmel, California. This is tape number 348, and it's August the 25th, 1978, side one. We're going to continue on this tape on both sides with an update of the Patty Hearst case. Since I wrote my article in 1974 and material that I haven't put on the cassettes to share with you since that time. Before I get into that, I just wanted to mention that in the bibliography that I give you, I have up in the corner a suggested title for your tape, and there's a tape on your cassette that is left blank, and write this in. The Tape Center doesn't have time to get out so many tapes and type this title for each week, and they don't know in advance, of course, what the title is going to be, and some people just get a number like number 342 or 346, whereas I used to be able to type in a single resume like SLA Hearst on the top. So when you get these tapes, take the suggested title that I've put, or if you have a better one, put it on the top of your tape and just do your own work and it'll be quickly done. There's no reason to not do it this way. You do have the bibliography and source that comes with it each week. Also, when I explained to you last week how Honey was breathing at my feet and sitting right next to me about few inches away every day, as soon as I talked about it, he got up and left, and it reminded me of the psychic fair I went to a couple weeks ago when they were talking about ghost houses, and they said that if there's a ghost in the house, you just say, "Welcome, I know you're here, and I'm sorry I'm intruding, because you were here before I came here, but don't mind if we stay here, we won't bother you, and we know you won't bother us." And usually the ghost around there doesn't cause as much problems, and there isn't that friction or anxiety that people get when they don't know how to handle it. And Honey was sitting here at my feet, and I tried that, and as soon as I said on the tape that he's sitting here and he never leaves me, and you'll have to bear with me if he's panting and so forth, he promptly picked himself up and went in the other room and stayed away. And that's the way things go. That's how you have to learn to handle certain matters. I think we have more control over our lives than we think we do. And the world moves in mysterious ways. And whenever I play these very direct kind of honest games with things, they seem to take care of themselves much quicker than if I sit and worry about it. And by next week, my cassette machine should be fixed. And hopefully it will. I think it has a better sound or more clear than this. But we'll limp along with this. And the answer to why all my machinery broke down, the cameras, the copying machine, the typewriter, the two tape cassettes, the answer will be found somewhere. If I don't let it perturb me and we work with what we've got, it's smooth sailing, and I'm sure it won't be a continuous thing, and it'll phase away. So we'll just bear with that, and by next week maybe things will be cleared up. If you have any question about tapes, if you're not getting tapes, write to Betty Phillips at the Tape Center and explain which ones you didn't get, and go directly to her so that you can save writing to me, and then I have to call her. And the checks come to my house where I enter them into a book to keep a double record and then send them on to her so that two of us can keep track if they're paid. But I don't send any bills, and that's a good way to lose friends and make enemies when you get entangled with money matters. So if there's any question on the billing, I'll send you a running sheet of the way I keep records if you can translate it. And hopefully things are going pretty smoothly and everybody's happy, I hope. Okay, back to the article that was in the Washington Post, because again, the New York Times suppressed this story and the Washington Post had a long story about Gerald Ford appointing Leo Chern to his advisory committee. Leo Chern was head of the International Rescue Committee, the IRC, long associated with the Central Intelligence Agency funds. It's been a CIA front for money. And besides working on the International Rescue Committee, Gerald Ford appointed Leo Chern to this advisory committee to look over the intelligence community. He appointed him 6 months after Leo Chern had known contact links with the Patty Hearst case with Randolph Hearst after he lost in Paris a very important book called The Green Book with a list of over 100 intelligence agents. Instead of firing him or passing him up, Gerald Ford promoted him to this very high position in spite of the fact that he had lost a book that endangered the security of the United States. And as I said last week, the book could have such names as Colston Westbrook, Willie Wolfe, Emily William Harris, Angela Atwood, Camille Hall, and various members of the CIA that were the SLA. I call them members of the CIA. We won't know. We never see the book in the eyes of national security. We're not going to know. But the recipient of this little book that was lost in Paris in March 1975, as I said last week, was Michael James Casey, who picked it up in Hong Kong or in Bangkok or South Vietnam. He won't say which of those three places. He was in all three in July of 1975. So from March to July, the book ended up in Southeast Asia in the hands of Michael Casey, who then took it to San Diego. And Michael Casey, as I said, was an ex-convict from Soledad. He had spent 2 years there on forgery charges, but he had been in Boys Town, Nebraska, where he did another thing which makes him terribly important. He took a list of files from them. It was a scandal that he took this list of files from Boys Town. And then he was hired by Leo Chern later to work for the International Rescue Committee, the CIA front. Casey has been linked to Phoenix agents of the Southeast Asian CIA operation, as I said, down at Camp Pendleton and with Premier Key and so forth. And he was also in touch with Judge Carter at the time of Patty Hearst's sentencing. Now, Emily William Harris had been charged with bank robbery after they were arrested, and it was a long time, another year before they had been charged with the arrest of Patty Hearst. Judge Carter died before Patty Hearst was sentenced, and he had been sent to a hospital for a mental analysis. There was a book that came out on federal judges and the control and the stupidity of them, and they described one Judge Carter in San Francisco who had mental breakdowns and was taken to a mental hospital and was literally mentally a zombie at times. That's what this book came out and stated. And Judge Carter dropped dead before Patty was sentenced. Now, the pressure of what Michael Casey told him or was corresponding with him about Patty Hearst might have been too much, and whatever it was, he isn't the first judge on an intelligence case who dies quickly just at the crucial sentencing time. Judge Battle died when he was hearing James Earl Ray's case, and he dropped over dead, and James Earl Ray was pronounced guilty, and now James Earl Ray is testifying before the House Select Committee that he didn't kill Martin Luther King. James Earl Ray had another hearing in Cincinnati on the case. It was moved to Cincinnati, Judge Miller, and Judge Miller was favorable to James Earl Ray having another trial, and Judge Miller died on the bench. A judge in the Alioto case, the mayor of San Francisco, had a case against Look magazine alleging that he was linked to organized crime. The judge up in Seattle dropped dead on the case. Well, the Washington Post had this long story. The New York Times didn't write anything about the links of the SLA. The Washington Post wrote about Judge Carter, the links of Michael Casey to Judge Carter, the links of Michael Casey to Randolph Hearst, and his interest in the SLA and the Phoenix program. The New York Times, the same date for the same article, had a headline, U.S. Investigating Loss of Notebook Containing National Security Data by Nicholas Hurek, the man who also writes about the Kennedy assassination and suppresses that evidence. But nowhere in the New York Times article did he mention any link of Michael Casey and to Randolph Hearst or Patricia Hearst or the CIA links in that little notebook. That was excluded. The Associated Press, United Press, Reuters, Earth News, Zodiac News, CBS, NBC, all the major media had nothing really about Leo Chern and his little green book and the links again to the SLA and the CIA. The only mention of these connecting links was actually by Lawrence Stern in the Washington Post. And he wrote about the links of the... It says that Michael Casey, a 32-year-old Californian who prides his work in the resettlement of the Vietnamese refugees, those are the Phoenix agents, sought to appear as a witness in behalf of Patty Hearst at her trial in charge of the bank robbery. And he wound up, in an ironic turn, instead working for the International Rescue Committee, of which Leo Chern was chairman of the board. So Michael Casey had wanted to testify for Patty Hearst, and of course you probably never heard his name until you received this tape, but he wasn't allowed to be at her trial at all. Not only was he director of Boys Town, but when he was fired over the 31 files that he took, they were allegedly for MGM Television, and Ken Reitz, I don't know if there's any connection or not, the man from the counterintelligence operations in the White House at the time of Watergate, went on to work for MGM, and he's now managing the political campaign of Evelyn Younger for governor in California. So everywhere this story, the Associated Press, United Press, Reuters, all of them, suppressed the story, and the Washington Post covered it. They said the Green Book is a government notepad that contains diplomatic and intelligence officers, and they told how it was lost in 1975. It has classified information. Leo Chern had CIA connections with President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board and also with his International Rescue Committee. He traveled with his aide, Commander Lionel Ulmer, who in 19 years with a Navy career of intelligence was always extremely meticulous. He was professional and experienced in handling classified material. Now, this is an interesting thing that I believe that in 1974, when I wrote the article, the SLA is the CIA, I called attention to the fact that Emily Harris had in her notebook the name of a Tim Casey in Orange County. And I wrote that in July 1974 about that, because when the six people were burned in Los Angeles by the Los Angeles SWAT team, Emily and William Harris took Patty Hearst to an apartment in Orange County outside of Disneyland. The 1974 shootout took place. Patty was driven by Emily and William Harris, and they end up in Disneyland a year later in 1974 at the time of the shootout in Oakland. Emily Harris had in her apartment, or when they were arrested for kidnapping Patty, the name of Tim Casey in Orange County. And Emily Harris knew a Casey out in Disneyland from 1973 to 74. This is just prior to Patty's kidnapping. She had worked at Disneyland. And Disneyland, of course, was the home of Ron Ziegler, who worked for Richard Nixon, the press secretary. He had worked in the jungle rides and the accounts, the public relations firm of J. Walter Thompson, has been to a conduit of CIA agents through the Mullen offices in Washington, D.C., and through the Mormon Church. And J. Walter Thompson also carried the Disneyland account. So that down in Disneyland in the summer before Emily Harris had gone up to the Bay Area, this college graduate with all this education and so forth, to kidnap Patty Hearst, she knew a Tim Casey in Disneyland, and I called attention to it in my article in 74. And then in 75, a Michael Casey comes out who works for the CIA and lives in the San Diego area. And then in 1976, it comes out that Michael Casey has the book of ages listed by Leo Chern. As I say, I wrote in the SLA article in 74, when the Harris's apartment was vacated in the Oakland area, after Patty was kidnapped, among the names left was an address book of Tim Casey from Orange County. Emily dated him during the summer of 67 and 68 while she worked at the Disneyland Hotel in California. Disneyland was the location of Ronald Ziegler to become press secretary for President Nixon. Disneyland Hotel and the San Francisco Police Department both used J. Walter Thompson Advertising Agency, the same agency that gave us Robert Haldeman, Dwight Chapin, Richard Nixon's White House plumber chiefs. Was Emily Harris in touch with espionage agents from Orange County? Now, nobody has confirmed that Tim and Michael Casey are the same or brothers or relatives, but nobody has denied it because nobody has looked into it. And yet, in 1975, Michael Casey surfaces and comes home in 76 or calls the authorities, and it's exposed in 76 that he, in fact, did get a book of these 100 agents from Leo Chern while in Europe. Another Tim Casey, I don't know if it's the same one Emily Harris dated or not, probably not, San Francisco police officer, was the person to bring in Patty Hearst and Wendy Yoshimura as I said last week on the tape, 3 weeks to the day that I said on the air that Patty Hearst would be brought in and had written to Randolph Hearst, Tim Casey went to the apartment. And Mr. Bates, Charles Bates, said on the TV, we didn't know where Patty was, but Tim Casey from the San Francisco Police Department went there. In the AP story at the time of September 20th, September 20, 1975, said police officer Tim Casey and FBI agent Tom Padden were seen by Wendy Yoshimura through a window in the door of their apartment on Moore Street that was owned by the San Francisco, a member of the San Francisco Police Department. Yoshimura opened the door. Hearst said, don't shoot, I'll go with you. And that ended the 592-day search of looking for Patty Hearst. Now, this book, this little green book, was discovered to be missing immediately after their arrival in the United States of Leo Chern and his Navy associate. He went to his Rockville, Maryland home, and he called Wheaton Byers, executive secretary of the Foreign Intelligence Board, and said, I've lost my notebook, it's missing. Then the headlines came out in 1975, Mystery Solved, Little Green Book Located. This is July 24th, 1975. But the mystery was hardly solved because of the transference of hands. Rather, 1976, the article came out, the mystery solved, the little green book located, and it turns out that Michael James Casey from Los Angeles called Leo Chern and said, I have your notebook. Now, I think with his links to the Southeast Asian Phoenix program, the CIA, Boys Town, and Time Magazine and NBC, and he goes to Asia and comes home with a book that was lost in Paris. I don't see where the mystery is solved at all, particularly since he's asking to testify at the Patty Hearst trial, and he has this information about Patty Hearst, and he's in charge with Judge Carter. Casey's explanation for receiving the book from Hong Kong, according to the Washington Post article, was that I got the book from sympathizers of Patty Hearst. And then he said, that's how it was returned to him by sympathizers for Patty Hearst. Well, where are these sympathizers? Whose names are in the book? They certainly weren't at her trial in San Francisco. And when the name Hearst came into this, the major media didn't cover it, only the Washington Post. And the same man, as I say, who took these 31 files from Boys Town, who was acquitted of felonious entry into the Boys Town, then went on to be hired by Leo Chern after this for the International Rescue Committee. Michael Casey said about the little green book that it was to help Patty, but as I say, I don't know how it did it, and I don't want to make it too confusing for you, except that the transference of the book, the death of Judge Carter, the silence of the media, and the similarity of the Caseys, one in San Diego, one in Orange County, makes it imperative to untangle this can of worms. August 25th, 26, 1975, when his notebook was returned, it was turned over to the intelligence staff, and 3 weeks later, Michael Casey, who worked for Leo Chern in the International Rescue Committee, was asked to resign from the International Rescue Committee. So Leo Chern had hired Casey, and Michael Casey did work for him. Now, April, May, and June, Casey said that he was working for Chern's organization and the CIA, and he used the credentials of Time Magazine to get over to Asia, and then he gets back. September 22nd, 1975, was the date that Michael Casey was in contact with Judge Carter, and he sent a telegram to him under the name of the International Rescue Committee, which was a CIA organization, and he asked them, Judge Carter, then, that Patty Hearst be given bail. And then Judge Carter passed away, and a new judge went on to the case shortly afterwards. After Chern lost his notebook, as I say, he was appointed and promoted instead of demoted to President Ford's extra sensitive Foreign Intelligence and Advisory Board. The question remains in all of this, how did Tim Casey in Southeast Asia get a hold of this list of agents that was lost in Europe. What names were on the list? Why was he in touch with Judge Carter? Why was he employed by Leo Chern of the Central Intelligence Agency? And how can we solve this particular Patty Hearst SLA CIA kidnapping without finding out if Emily Harris was dating a Michael Casey who was the same as Tim or a blood relative of Casey's down in Orange County? I think the clue of how they escaped the fire in Los Angeles the night before all the SLA members were burned, Emily William Harris took Patty in a car and they went to see a drive-in movie and had dinner, and they didn't go back and tell the others that they had left a van with their address in it, and the others were all killed. And then they had Patty located at a hotel in Disneyland, where by the evening news and the burning of the SLA, she saw it on television. And that's a very important part of Patty Hearst's mind control, is that she viewed all of them being killed, and they kept telling her that your family doesn't know if you're inside or not, and everybody is letting you die. You're meaningless. You don't mean anything to them. We're the only ones you can trust. You'll stay with us. And after seeing them all killed, she didn't know at the time, Patty didn't know, that the police department had dogs that had sniffed her clothes and were familiar with her odors. And I saw the movies that Lake Headley has of the dogs going up to the cottage before the shootout and sniffing around and going away. And they're sitting on the sidewalk out there watching the house burn where the six people are inside. And he's not frantic at all. The dog knows that she isn't inside. But Patty doesn't know that. And how did they get her to a hotel in Disneyland, such a straight environment? Emily William Harris took her there. Emily was familiar with Disneyland. She had been there. And they had Patty sitting and watching TV, which is kind of a funny thing to be doing at this particular hour. And you think they'd be fleeing the area. But they were watching television, and then Patty's mind was locked. In the scene of that fire, with what they said to her, she could be mesmerized or drugged or just told absolutely, see, nobody cares about you. For all purposes, you're dead. This is what the FBI does. This is what the police do. And Evelyn Bailey let admission come into the trial of things that happened after the robbery of the Hibernia Bank. But he didn't admit any investigation of the Harrises, of Casey's, and Leo Chern, or the list of agents, to the fact that Patricia Hearst had indeed not only been picked up and kept in a closet for 54 days and handcuffed and in a dark room and terrorized and filled with guilt, but the terrorizing continued down in the Los Angeles area with the Harrises in control of Patty Hearst. She hated them, and instinctively people get certain vibes about others that they're with, and she had nothing to go on to know who Emily William Harris were, but she hated being with them, she said later. I said on the tape last week that Donald DeFries was killed by bullets close up. The first story was that he committed suicide, and then in May of 1975, there was a United Press article, Sinque, that was the name given to Donald DeFries in Vacaville, didn't kill himself, and it's got consultants laid on the police, Dr. Ronald Taylor, director of the forensic laboratory in the coroner's office, and Dr. Vincent Gwynn, a chemistry professor at UC Irvine, and a scientific consultant, claimed that the analyzers of the ballistic test do not bear out Thomas Noguchi's conclusion that Donald DeFries killed himself. Our data doesn't support suicide. They support homicide. They didn't prove it, but it looks to us like DeFries was killed with a nickel-plated, steel-jacketed bullet, they said. It was a .38 caliber revolver that was found under Donald DeFries with copper jacket bullets, but they said we have additional information that very likely at least one member of the Los Angeles Police Department SWAT team may have fired a different kind of ammunition than we received in the initial samples. This was non-regulation ammunition, allegedly, and was supposedly of World War II surplus, of ammunition of foreign manufacture, steel jacket, rather than a copper jacket. Now, if they have a single person, different than the SWAT team, with a different kind of ammunition and bullet, was that, in fact, the Don Gray that was described by Mr. Lewis, who shot Donald DeFries at close range, and it was not the SWAT department of the Los Angeles Police Department from the front. They burst fire into the house, but there were different kinds of bullets, and they claimed that one person had fired from a different kind of a bullet that had killed Donald DeFries. This information came out May 23, 1975. My article, July 1974, said that Donald DeFries was killed at close range by a man in a sweatshirt running down the alley from in back of the house. One of the big mysteries of the SLA story is the book Black Abductor that I wrote about in 1974. It was published in San Diego. That's the home of Mickey and Jack Scott. That's where they were at the time that they were arrested. They weren't arrested. They were recognized for having taken Patty from the Bay Area to Pennsylvania and then back to the Bay Area. The book was published by Regency Publisher, a non-existent publisher, and the author was Harrison James, who to this day has never come forward to claim his miraculous writing of this book in 1974. When Patty wasn't kidnapped until 1974. Of course, the CIA used book publishers and pornographers, and they had a book publishing company run by Robert Mayhew in San Diego, simulated pictures of Sukarno they were making, saying that he was chasing around with different women, and the CIA has gotten out books in advance of actions or afterwards that were published by their non-existent publishers. They're not for ordinary people from off the street. I will read you briefly from my notes I have from the book Black Abductor, what the book says, the first line, and then what actually happened in the case of Patty Hearst to show the similarity. The heroine in each book was called Patricia. They both came, both Patricias, from wealthy conservative families. In the book, she went from Cordell University. In real life, Patty went to Cal University in Berkeley. Both women were kidnapped at night near the campus. Both of them were dragged out half naked. In each case, in the book and in real life, the boyfriend was beaten. Stephen Weed was beat up in this case. The abductors were multiracial, a black man with white women. They were described as a ragtag group of ideologues of mixed sexes. The boyfriend was a suspect in the book, and he is a suspect in real life. The leader of the group that kidnapped the Patricia was an embittered black man in the book and described as embittered black man in real life. The abductors used Polaroid pictures of the victim to send their messages in the book, Black Abductor, and 2 years later they used a Polaroid picture to take messages to pass on. It was called America's First Political Kidnapping in the book, and Patty Hearst's kidnapping was called America's First Political Kidnapping. Discounting the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, this was to escalate not individual violence, but the great terrorism that we see all over the world, and hopefully to link it to international terrorism around the world. In the book, it was modeled after Latin American terrorists, and in real life, it was modeled after Latin American terrorists, and they took the name of Tanya, the dead woman that died when Che Guevara was killed. One woman in the group was lesbian or more lesbian than the others, and in the SLA group, Ms. Moon and Camila Hall were the two lesbians that were incorporated. The book was described as a fictional precursor, but the law of probability of these things happening is just, according to some experts, too great to calculate, and it seems that somebody knew a lot about what was to take place in 1974. And if Charlie Bates was brought out through the Tom Charles Houston plan to the area in San Francisco in 72, then all the groundwork was being laid for this operation. It's also interesting to note that in the article I wrote in 1974, I went in great length that this was a Tom Charles Houston COINTEL operation directed from the Pentagon and the White House. And it later came out at the time Spiro Agnew became president of a foundation in Bloomington, Indiana, that it was the place where Emily William Harris and Angela and Gary Atwood had attended in Bloomington, Indiana. And the lawyer who wrote the rules and bylaws for the foundation that Spiro Agnew is now president of is Tom Charles Houston, who was working in the White House with Richard Nixon and Navy and Army Intelligence and Defense Intelligence Agency and the FBI. The same Tom Charles Houston whose operation I described in the SLA as the CIA was the lawyer for the foundation in Bloomington, Indiana, where the Harrises and Atwoods came from, and Spiro Agnew now works there with the oil people from the Middle East. More about the CIA and the SLA on the next side of this tape.